September 26th. Today I walked at Woodard Bay again. My first instinctive adjective for this place a few weeks ago was magical, like Moxley Creek, but on super steroids. There is one spot in particular about 100 yards up the side path into the woods where the trees, firs, cedars, hemlocks are huge, closely packed, rising higher than I can see all around, creating an enchanting shade, both breathtaking and step-stopping, in that I always halt there and gasp. That magical. Today, I tried to see if I could come up with some reasons why, though, of course, magic does not need and is ultimately beyond our reasons. The first thing I thought about was how quiet it is, almost preternaturally quiet by contemporary standards, even in a smaller town like Olympia, let alone the cities I've lived in previously. Ceaseless traffic noise punctuated by an occasional siren that recedes beneath notice after a few days there. For some reason, this place has none of that. Part of it, I'm sure, has to do with how it is situated geographically, between two hills, blocking road noise, and two strips of Puget Sound water preventing suburban encroachment. I mentioned earlier how you walk into the place, down a paved path between high banks, all of those old-growth trees looming high on either side, the mountainous rifts of ferns cascading up and around and over the ground beneath them, as far as I can see. It is instant serenity. Not many people come to walk here, and the ones that do walk slowly, calmly, speak very softly, if at all. Serene presences, almost like a dream. Watershed Park in downtown Olympia is busier. Walkers who walk with purpose, exercise, say, or stress reduction on breaks from work, all of them passing me out on one of my slower days, sometimes lapping me along the way. Even the serenity seekers work at it, sitting on a bench, say, in lotus position, breathing deeply. At Woodard Bay, there is none of any of that. Just slow. Serenity on the cheap. I'm right now in the midst of one of my intermittent, extended periods of disequilibrium, a balance disorder that got married to my hereditary migraines about 25 years ago. A very unpleasant couple they make, exponentially worse than either was before they exchanged their vows. This one has been going on for about a month, precipitated by something so stupid and boring I won't even tell you the story. I figure it's got about another month in it if I'm careful and lucky. It takes a lot of energy and attention for me to navigate my way during these interims, all of it entirely invisible to others. My left leg in particular is making constant micro-adjustments like someone on a tightrope might be making, even when everything looks stable. By day's end, that leg is tired. One of the things I noticed this time and wanted to change was how I instinctively walked during these episodes. For one thing, I tend to look down, about 6 to 8 feet ahead, as a way of focusing on a straight, well-grounded path forward. And my gait has a side-to-side sway to it, again, I assume, to make me feel grounded. I decided a couple of days ago to try to change all of that. Not so much because it would get me back to balance faster, just because I thought it made me seem even older than I already am. So my mantra has been, stand tall, look straight ahead, stride directly forward, over and over. Even if it's harder than what I've been doing, over and over. I doubt it will help with my condition, but at least I feel like I have some work to do while it's here. I also tend to rely very heavily on my vision to keep upright. Closed eyes especially are not good. Taking a shower, sleeping, things like that. I've read enough about this condition to understand why, and the one time I tried rehab, a lot of the work was vision-oriented. But today, because of what I say above, I started to think about sound in relation to centeredness and grounding. It is, yes, very quiet at Woodard Bay, but not silent. So the sounds that emerge seem, actually, much louder than they would or do back in town. I thought for the first time about how hearing resembles seeing, which I've spent more time talking about here, in that it is relative. We acclimate ourselves to ambient sounds in much the same way that we acclimate ourselves to visual stimuli. Why, I, a poet who makes sound my business in a way, never wrote much about this in a routine, experiential way, well, I have no idea. Though I have written a lot about it professionally via Poetics. But in any case, I noticed it today, mostly and loudly, because it was so quiet. Given the topography of the site, the only way loud sounds can intrude is from above. Today, for example, I heard a very loud cloppity-clop, probably a helicopter, just as my walk started. I looked up, but could not see it, which means it must have been at least a mile away. Over the next 5 minutes or so, maybe more, the stutter of the rotors gradually blended into a continuous, well, roar. So intrusive was it on the surrounding quiet, which then, gradually and very slowly, diminished. And still, I couldn't see the source. It was maybe 10 minutes before I could no longer hear it, which means it was, by then, many miles away. I hear helicopters go over my house quite often. I have no idea why. Maybe the hospital just down the road. I can hear the rumble of such a sound right now while I'm typing this. If I'm recording, I need to stop. But I rarely hear them for more than a minute or so, which means to me that the other ambient noise must mask their sound fairly quickly. Noise canceling of a sort. Once the copter sound stopped, it got very, very quiet. As I walked toward the point, the sound of my shoes on the gritty path was loud, annoyingly loud, and no matter how I tried to soften my step, the kind of sound my feet make all day long without my ever hearing it was, well, annoying. So I just stopped, stood still, overlooking vast stretches of very calm water. It was such a bright, sunny day today. Maybe 20 or so gulls of various sizes gliding around, taking flight, calling out. So peaceful. Serene. I could hear quite distinctly the pounding of a hammer from a distance. Some man, I figured, fixing something, since it would be 5 or 6 steel-on-steel strikes. Quiet. Then 5 or 6 more, maybe 3 or 4 iterations. It was clearly coming from across the bay, at least a mile away, maybe more, way too far to see even a house, let alone a man hammering. That's how quiet it got. I reveled in it. I've read that there is a spot in the whole rainforest, a couple of hours from here, where one can experience nearly complete silence, at least from human sources. One of the quietest spots in the country, they say. What I thought today was that I don't really need to go there now, though maybe I will, because I could experience a form of silence today even more precious than that, the kind that the imagination creates by editing out the one intrusive sound disrupting it. Or maybe it actually is that intrusive sound that highlights what silence might be, makes it almost visible in a way. I toyed with the idea of how sound might, like sight, become a centering mechanism for me when I'm off kilter like this. But as soon as I got back on the road, I knew that would be pointless. On the road, in town, even at home in a very sedate neighborhood, there is so much ambient sound coming in from so many directions and the ears are so acclimated to it that it would be impossible to triangulate positional space with it. Here, for a few minutes, I could do it, a form of balance. I noticed today something else, noise-wise, I've always marveled at. Many of the sounds of nature are pleasant to the ear, even when they are very loud, as the seagulls were today when they shrieked, or, my template for this oddity, the cicadas back east, almost deafeningly loud in late August, yet pleasant enough to fall asleep to. If it were a neighbor's generator, you'd want to take a shotgun to it. Obviously, we are genetically predisposed by long exposure to enjoy such sounds, feel at home with them. And of course, there are rarely 10 or 12 different kinds of sound competing and combining chorally there as there are when we're in human company. The two or three that are become like music, very soothing, inducing calm, even sleep if you're in the right position for it. One of the things noise does for us is to mark time. Music is the best example, that rhythmic structuring of the time it takes for a piece to run its course. We lend ourselves to that time sequence, enjoy it, sometimes even crave its continuation. But for me at least, almost always, when the musical phrasing ends, I'm satisfied with it, ready to move on to the next, or just go back to the randomness of noise that emerges outside of music. Sound, then, almost always invites me to think about time, and I did that in intermittent stages on my walk today. My meditation started right from the time I got out of the car, really. I stopped to watch the water rushing out with the tide, a strong stream of it coming from under the bridge, and then into a narrow channel right in the center of the bay, a channel cut, I presumed, then carved deeper over time, precisely for this purpose. When I looked at the bank up toward the road, I could see countless tiny little trickles of water draining out from the earth there into the sunlight, a shimmering wall, maybe 4 feet high and 40 feet long, all well above the waterline, but still pouring their portion into the outflow. It was mesmerizing. I wondered how much water could be stored back there in the bank, waiting to be released like this, how long it might last. When I got back to the car, after about 45 minutes, the bay nearly empty, that shimmering wall of water was still going strong. A year or so ago, on a walk back in Pittsburgh, when I was thinking about time, I had an image come into my head which looked like a froth of bubbles. That image was, I believed, trying to tell me something about time, that it was not at all a linear vector, piercing forward from the richness and doneness of the past into an unconstructed, blank future, fiercely regulated by the kinds of increments we measure with clocks. But more like incoming surf, a wavelength repeating itself, the same liquid over and over, coming in cycles, continuously new and renewed. These waves in time, I thought, just as they are in space, could be mild and rhythmic, or massive and scary, or really infinitely varied. I rushed home and wrote up what I thought about that day. I shared this piece with as many young people as I could in the hopes that one among them might someday be able to determine, mathematically, whether it was plausible. I think most of them thought it was interesting, but a little weird. Like, why even bother? I put it up on my website, and like everything else there, it incited no replies. I know enough about physics to presume that time, in its fundamental essence, must be just as unfathomably strange as quantum mechanics tells us space is. The right minds just haven't spent enough time thinking about it, experimenting with it. Things in space are so much easier to work with. Einstein, of course, did bring time into intimate dimensional relationship with space, a huge advance. But I'm sure there's way more to it than that. Mind-blowing strangenesses. One day my sister was talking about a high-level string theory physicist she knew through her legal work. I asked her to send what I wrote to them in the hopes that he might say that it could have some mathematical plausibility in our universe. He never responded, but for some reason she shared it with a few of her other friends. One of them did respond to her, saying how beautiful this way of thinking about time was, how it moved her to tears to read it, helped her to cope with some things ongoing in her life. I have no idea about the what or the why. I'm just thrilled to have had my image land so softly in the right place. That's the wonderful thing about the kind of writing I do now, never publishing anything in the traditional marketplace. Somehow, over and over, pieces seem to seek out and find the one person, and it is often only one person, who needs to hear it right then. It has happened repeatedly that way. Someone I never met, or someone I've known forever, who is moved in exactly the way any writer hopes to move others. And they tell me. Every single time, I, too, am moved. Forget completely whatever irritation or frustration I might feel about my inability to find a larger audience. Moved to tears of my own. In any case, here's what I wrote that day back in Pittsburgh. You didn't think I'd let you off the hook that easily, did you? I've always been skeptical about the infinite alternate universe aspect of the multiverse model, at least the way it is rendered in Discovery Channel shows, my primary contact with contemporary physics. In its simplest form, as I understand it, at each juncture of one's life, and the temporal frequency of such junctures seems never to be clearly specified. By either choice or accident or necessity, my lifeline goes off on one path, while multiple alternate versions of me proceed on multiple, again, the exact number is never clearly specified, alternate paths, like particles flying off after a collision in the Large Hadron Collider. And on, all of this times billions of other lives and trillions of other junctures. This model seems to be exceedingly complex, random, clunky, and honestly, nonsensical. I prefer to think that the universe is more elegant than this. Still, there is so much theoretical framing for something of this sort, inflation, gravitational waves, quantum duality, string theory, etc. It is equally unlikely that the old standard model, one life, one path, that's it, is adequately explanatory. So I was walking in the woods one morning trying to fathom exactly what was wrong with the stereotypical infinite alternate universe model, and this thought came to me. It depends on a unilinear conception of time, the past always and only pressing into the future, the arrowhead of the vector of time locked in at the present moment, past receding behind, now fully formed, in infinite iterations, the future essentially empty, a blank slate waiting to be occupied by all those scattering particles. This way of thinking about time has seemed naive to me ever since I was a kid, frankly, and more so as I think and read more about time. Time, I believe, is a fully extended, fluid field, the future already extant as something analogous to potential energy, and it approaches us, actually comes toward us, in a generally amicable way as we stride into it, come to occupy it. In other words, the future is just as real as the past, though it remains immaterialized until we inhabit it. The image that came to me to capture this, at least as it pertains to infinite alternatives, was a wave tipped with a froth of bubbles, an infinite number of such bubbles, as it slips toward shore. All of the bubbles, as a whole, are relatively undifferentiated, like a froth is, rather than singular, like the ones we might blow in the backyard. Each individual bubble pre-constitutes a futural space with the potential for life, but it remains indeterminate, empty, until we interact with it, filling it with life, realizing it in time. As we cross into that froth, we encounter only a small number of those bubbles, of course, and these are activated. As a consequence, a certain number of other bubbles on that wave and successive incoming waves become viable for life, waiting for us, full of potential. And a huge number of others become untenable, unlivable, dead. And these pop. Done. Gone. Only one life goes on, though it still has infinite alternatives available to it in the future that approaches it. Time in this model is more like a series of interacting tides, future approaching, past moving forward, back and forth, the present, the scene of their interaction. About a month later, on another walk, it struck me that this could also account for one of the other conundrums that has long afflicted my thinking. What part of our lifeline is a matter of choice, free will, responsive to our desires, controllable? And what part is a matter of fate, or, my preferred word, destiny, essentially out of our control, even if not entirely predetermined. I do believe that choice is foundational to the human experience, organizes our ways of being in the world. But I also believe, based on my experiences, that certain paths, events, whatever, are precast, obligatory, insist on happening or not happening, no matter how hard I might try, have tried, to avoid or achieve them. The frothy wave accounts for this in this way. Many, maybe most of the waves we walk into and through are relatively mild, yielding to our intentions, letting us choose more or less the bubbles we prefer to interact with and enliven. Others come at odd angles, surprise us, are beyond our control, like the sort of extrinsic, historical or cultural or physical forces that are non-negotiable, belong to the time period and the body we are, for whatever reason, compelled to inhabit. These enliven accidental bubble chains, beyond our control. Then there are other waves that come head-on, but strong, forcing us to live in certain bubble chains whether we like it or not. Many of the major events or changes in my own life seem to have been inescapable in this way. They just had to happen, for whatever reason. This is what I call destiny. All three of these can be accounted for interactively in the froth. Finally, I think this can also account for that common human experience of seeing one's life flash before our eyes when we think we're about to die. There is no way one could see all the junctures and variations in the standard model of the infinite alternate universe theory in a flash. But one could see in an instant the string of interconnected bubbles that, in the end, account for our life. We might even be able to see them as one bubble, all of them collapsing into a single integrated whole. When we actually die, of course, all of the infinite number of remaining bubbles on the waves incoming probably pop or evaporate. But who knows? Maybe we go to another level, where we can see, simultaneously, not only the whole, timeless bubble of our lived life, but even all the other unrealized lives in the infinite number of bubbles that popped or remain. Maybe we can even see all of that in a flash, too. That would be cool. Note, the bubbles in my metaphor have nothing to do with the bubble universes that inflation seems to make at least theoretically possible. Mine are bubbles in time first, then space, not vice versa. Today, that shimmering wall of water, seemingly ceaseless, added a new layer to my thinking about time. To be honest, I'm not yet sure what it is, but shimmering wall and froth of bubbles may have some hidden mathematical convergence, the sum of which is time. I'll have to come back to this for further thinking. Time, of course, moves in a much larger register in the natural world. For example, it is now fall. On my walk, there was a fluttering of leaves, like single droplets, presaging longer and stronger showers later. One of the odd things I noticed here is that some of the trees change colors very quickly, and all at once. What was all green a few days ago was now all yellow, or brown, or orange. No reds yet. Maybe these trees don't traffic in that particular extravagance, being extravagant enough already in size and age. But the leaves stayed put, except for these few dribs and drabs floating in front of me. I wonder, maybe the leaves here come down all at once, too, the way they change colors. Time will tell, as it always does. One of the ironies of my experience of silence in this place, Woodard Bay, at this moment in time, is that just 60 years ago, the noise here, as I said, would have been unbearable. All those huge logs, sawn and fallen in the surrounding forest, hauled by rail car right out into the bay here and dumped sidewise into the water, hordes of men with spiked shoes scooting around on this rolling wooden sea to herd them into rafts to be floated up and away toward their markets. When you look at the remnants of the infrastructure that made this possible, You can almost still hear the echoes of all that menacing mechanical fury. Rail cars clanking, men yelling, big boats rumbling. Were I standing here then, I would not be hearing the sound of my shoes on grit. I would not even be able to hear myself think, most likely. I've done some hard work in my life. Not on this scale, of course, but physically demanding work, sweat pouring out work. One of the most enjoyable things about that kind of exertion is that it shuts off thinking. The body just absorbs all of that mental energy, uses it to do physical things, make stuff happen. I'm too old for that now, but like running fast as the wind, which I did as a kid, I miss it. There's freedom in it, from the monotonies of the mind, from the rigors of silence, from time even to a certain extent, from being absorbed into an unbroken sequence of extended nows. It is always just one now, when you are a body working hard, sweating. Sweet. There are, of course, other echoes in this place. Native Americans making their living on the bounties of the sea much more quietly, much longer ago, for example. And then, before that even, just these same animals. Otters, seals, seagulls, cormorants, herons, kingfishers, making their deeply pleasing sounds with and for one another. No one else here to listen. The world here right now is, fortunately for me, much closer to that than it has been for well over 100 years. I won't say I'm necessarily lucky to be standing here now instead of any of those other thens. Time is neutral. You get what you get of it. Whatever noises the world around makes while you're here. It allows for what space places in its path as it laps ashore over and over, as it is doing here right now at my feet, or shimmers like a wall of diamonds while we watch it emerge seemingly out of nothing, that hard dirt bank, so beautiful, endless, just there and there and there.